Recording. That's a good sign.
So if you look at your agenda, I want to take you through that. The first thing you'll notice, hopefully, is that this is not an original course by me. This is based on a series of classes, at least three different series, kind of all melded together by Rabbi Yitzchak Berkowitz, who had been teaching at Eshet Torah.
I was looking for that.
He now has his own program, but he's a master at taking very complicated material, condensing it, and making very palatable. He's highly regarded and highly respected in a number of different circles. He volunteers his efforts for a number of different major international organizations, notably the Chafetz Chaim Foundation, in their efforts to stem the tide against Lashon Hara. You know, and he does a lot of various series of classes for them, all kinds of stuff. So he introduces his halacha series, which is a very lengthy 2 or 3 year everyday series, going through the Mishnah Berurah, going through the Shulchan Aruch. He introduces it with these ideas, and at a beginner's level, an advanced level, and an intermediate. And I kind of put all that together, and I think, and Rabbi Cohen agrees, that this is a very important basis by which we understand how halacha really works, how Jewish law really works, what it's all about. Usually, and this is true for not only Bali Tshuva, but for from birth people as well. Because I can tell you from where my kids are, you know, that I got two high schoolers now, so they learn halacha, and this is what you need to do, right? They learn it inside. They learn the text material on it. They're very good at, you know, understanding, you know, this is what this sefer or this sefer, this says. These are the exceptions, these are the rules. And at least the boys certainly will know, you know, Mishnah Gemara. And some of the boys will eventually go to, you know, they'll go to Rishonim, they'll go to some early commentators on the Gemara, but they never, except for the very late years, bridge the gap. You know, it's all a continuum. That's one of the goals to help you see, is that it really is a continuum. And there's no way, even if you were to sit in Kollel 16 hours a day, it will take you about 20 years to go through every single question or common question that comes up throughout the oral law and go from beginning to end, from the Torah to what the oral Torah says, to Mishnah Gemara, etc., all the way to current commentators. But I want to show you how it all works together. That's really the goal. And beyond that, the other goal is to kind of like look at Jewish religion / philosophy as science, natural science. Okay, that'll be, as we'll see in a moment, the next 3 weeks after this week. So let's take a look at this. Today we're going to, it's like an overview. We'll look at like a 30,000 foot overview of the oral law. I'll emphasize these three sources. I'll give you handouts in a moment. Then the next 3 weeks will be the definition of halacha and how Orthodox Jews, how traditional Torah-minded Jews view practiced religion. What is it? What happens? We're going to define it as natural laws of the spiritual world, just as there's natural laws of the physical world. Gravity, for example, you know, you can assume, you can state to yourself, I don't believe in gravity, but things are still going to fall because of gravity. There are similarly, the same way, in the same time, spiritual laws. And it helps you have a mindset. But once you get that definition, you're going to have a dozen questions right away. Among them are, you know, we learn that there are different types of commandments. There's chukim, mishpatim. You've heard these terms before. I'll define them more closely. There are laws that are black, very black and white. You know, is this animal kosher? No. You know, it doesn't matter how you feel about it, or if it's a Wednesday or a Thursday, it's just not a kosher animal. Okay. On the other hand, there are what's called mishpatim, like honor your parents. You know, those, it does depend. A singular act can be an honorable act, and it could also be a non-honorable act, and we'll give examples of that. So, how does that work into a natural science? If it's a science, then it should be fairly clear. Seems like it's not. How does that work? Also, we know that we differentiate based on what's called in Hebrew, and it's important to know some of these terms. Mazid, it says here, shogeg, misasek, something done intentionally, something done inadvertently. Perhaps you can say carelessly, maybe. You didn't want to do it, certainly, but maybe had we been more careful, we wouldn't have done it. Or we did it entirely an error. It wasn't. It was like you tripped and turned on light bulb on Shabbos, you know, and falling. Right? That was it had nothing to do with my intention. So we'll see that the degree of damage done to one's soul varies enormously between those three situations. And why? Same act was done. We'll talk also about rabbinical law. We'll talk about custom and how that works into the science. These are questions that people have all the time. These are questions that people bring up at your Shabbos table. These are questions that even we have frequently. Our children will have at some point frequently. We'll talk about something today that our kids and I, you know, frequently ask, and that is, well, they may ask in those words, but the veracity of Midrash. How true is Midrash or Agadatha stories? Right? Did it really happen? Did it didn't happen? Okay? And I'll teach you how to answer that question. I'll teach you how the Ramchal answers, the Lutzato answers the question, so it's not just me. Okay? And then we'll talk history. History can be dry. I hope to make it very non-dry and very interesting and show you really how the oral law developed from God to Moses all the way to current day post-king. Okay? So that'll take several weeks to do. And then that's our 7 weeks. Now, it may be 8 weeks because one of those Sundays I think I'm not going to be available. And hopefully the rest will be fine. Okay? That's the goal. Any questions to start? Okay, great. Okay. Let's begin. Okay? Now, the oral law. What is the oral law? Where did it come from? Why do we study it? If we talk about men learning in yeshiva, standard yeshiva from high school boys and on. Okay, from 9th grade on, well, let's just 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th, 12th, 12th, maybe not 12th, but certainly 9th and 11th, they have general studies. The Jewish studies portion of that is about 80% oral law review discussion. Okay? 90%. If you go beyond that, post high school, it's all 95% to 100%. And as far as you go, if they go to Kollel for 5-10 years, that's all they do. Why? Why is it just basically focusing on driving themselves, you know, hours and hours and hours and hours at a time to focus on that? What is it all about? So, to get a feel for it, I made you copies of the Rambam's, it's called the Hakadama of the Mishnah Torah. Now, I hope I'm not intending to insult anybody, but I don't know you at all, so I don't know what you know in the background. So have you heard of the Rambam, the Maimonides, right? Mm-hmm. Have you heard of
it? Yeah, I must have read this before, but
this looks familiar.
A darn thing, probably 8 years ago.
Okay,
I heard
very
a darn
good.
Thing about it, so it's
okay,
it's
all new to me. Good. Maimonides is a Greek name. his name is Moshe. His father, they didn't have last names then. His father's name was Maimon. So he's known as Moshe ben Maimon. That's in Greek style, in Latin style, Edes means son of. Okay? Like if you know Persians, you'll see frequently it's Azeh, or Azadeh, right? There are people like something, Aranzadeh, Kohenzadeh, right? That means son of, or Yosef Zadeh, right? You'll see some like that. So that's various cultures have that, and that was Greek / Latin culture. We refer to him as Rambam, which is an acronym, Resh Mem, you see it in Hebrew if you can read it, HaRambam, so that's Resh Mem Beis Mem, which stands for Rabbeinu, our rabbi, our teacher, Moshe ben Maimon. Okay? So a lot of these funny names, Rashi, Rambam, the Ramah, lots of those, okay? Those are all acronyms in Hebrew. Okay? And then they're transliterated into English, of course, right? So that's his name. Okay, he wrote a number. He was a major, major figure in Jewish history. Arguably, perhaps even maybe the greatest figure, certainly post Gemara, post Talmud. His opus, his magnus opus, is what's called the Mishnah Torah. Okay, and that's what this is. And this is the introduction to the Mishnah Torah. That's the name of the book. Mishnah literally means repetition or learning, reviewing. Okay, from.
When did he exist?
That's a good question. Sorry, he lived in the 11 and 1200s. Okay, and he lived in Spain, beginning of his life, but chased out not during the expulsion, but during the takeover of one Muslim sect by another Muslim sect, who was a bit more, we'd call them fundamentalists, I guess. Instead, that way they didn't call them then; they called them monsters. But they chased a lot of people out, and the Rambam and his family, this is still a young man, to cross over the Gibraltar Straits to Morocco, and then Tunisia, and then eventually to Egypt. And he spent most of the rest of his adult life in Egypt, and was very sorry that he didn't live out his life in Israel, but beyond the scope of this discussion, okay? That was the Rambam.
He's a person that's commenting on the Mishnah Torah.
No, the name of his book is called the Mishnah Torah.
Oh.
This is the Mishnah Torah. So this is the introduction to his book called the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah, and we'll talk about it in the history section, was really the first attempt to take all of halacha from all this, okay, and condense it to not a small volume, a sizable volume, but nonetheless, it's all you need to know. As we'll see.
But the oral Torah was before him,
yes,
obviously.
Yes.
But he is the first person to, so to speak, put it into a language that most of us could understand.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's actually one of the beauties of the Mishnah Torah is it's very easy to read and easy to learn because he's a master at Hebrew language, and there's enough repetition that you understand, even if you don't know the Hebrew language, you look it up once, and soon enough you'll be figuring out things as you go along. That's intentional. He does that intentionally. He's just a master educator. So,
this is not the one that wrote the book for his son for Bar Mitzvah.
No,
that's another,
right.
Another Spanish.
Right. That's the Sefer Achinuch. That's
okay.
The thing, right.
Right.
But we're not going to.
Okay.
That's another, altogether another thing.
Okay.
Okay, so the Rambam begins his introduction. The very beginning of the very beginning of... you cold? You can turn it down if you'd like.
Yeah,
okay.
I don't want to turn it down.
Oh.
The trick is apparently close
it's in
the
there.
Door, but I don't want to close the door because I don't want people to...
It's, well, you know, maybe like 8:15 or 8:20 we can close the door.
So. Let me see if I just...
You want to close this door here? Or just this door?
I don't think it'll matter.
Oh.
You know what? It's okay. I'll
okay.
Just close it. I think,
you know what? Maybe it's on a timer and we can... Is this timer the lights or the...
That is the light, I think. Yeah, that's the light. You know what? Don't worry about it.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Okay.
So, I'm going to try... How's your Hebrew?
Good.
Oh, yeah. How's your Hebrew?
Not good.
Let's do English. Okay, let's look at the left side then. Okay, the mitzvahs were given to Moses at Mount Sinai. I'm sorry, the mitzvahs given to Moses at Mount Sinai. But you're familiar that Moses went up to Mount Sinai to get the Torah, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows he went out to Mount Sinai to get the Torah. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's not true. Some people who watch the movie only think he was down at the bottom, and God gave the Torah from the top. That's not true, right?
Mm-hmm.
You hope that's very important. The movie was wrong, and it's an important difference. Okay, so Moses goes upstairs, you know, and God speaks to him for 40 days and 40 nights, right? Now, what did he say? What did he do over that time? We're all given together with explanations as... implied, I guess it says that there, sorry, by Exodus 24:12. Quote, and here it's worthwhile. Do you have any Hebrew skills whatsoever? Can you follow along if
I
read?
Yeah, I have some Hebrew
Excellent.
Skills.
Excellent. So quote begins here.
But I don't know what it means.
Okay, I'll explain. Okay. This is a direct quote from Exodus 24:12, and that's when Moses, that's after the Ten Commandments are given already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he's asked to go up. It says, Ve'etana, so you should go up, and the commandment still comes, and then it continues, Ve'etana, I will give you, that's a word from Natan, Noten, Lecha, to you. Okay? Ve'etana, I will give it, feminine, the Torah, okay? Etna, Lecha, I will give to you, et Luchot Ha'evan, the stone tablets, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Ve'ha'Torah, we'll leave that untranslated right now, the Torah, Ve'ha'Mitzvah. And the mitzvah. Okay, so before we go further...
He's separating the Torah from the mitzvah.
Yeah, so I think we can understand pretty clearly what does it mean, Luchot Ha'evan. That's pretty clear. That's the tablets of stone. That's what the Ten Commandments were engraved on. It says that clearly elsewhere, at least two or three times. Okay, so that's what that is. We understand that. And there's two other things that God's going to give Moses. It says, I will give you. Okay, he's going to give him the Torah and he's going to give him the mitzvah. So what are those two things? So the Rambam continues. Torah, zu, Torah shebiksav. This is the written Torah. The word Torah, when this statement, this quote in the Torah, in the Bible, is given, the word Torah here refers to the written Torah. And when it says the mitzvah, That's the third thing he's going to give them, right? That means the explanation, perusheha, okay, or perusha, the meanings of what it means. God commanded us to fulfill the Torah according to the mitzvah, meaning that you have the mitzvah, the explanation, that, in other words, the Torah, I'm going to give you the Torah, I'm also going to give you its explanations. Right? This mitzvah is what we call the oral law. Okay? So where does the Rambam, is he making this up, you think? This is his own clever understanding? I mean, can I pick up the Sefer Torah or Chumash, you know, the art scroll, and decide, you know what I think this means? I think it means this. So is this what the Rambam's doing? Is he just being, I mean, he's very intelligent. He could do it, certainly much wiser than any of us. The answer is no, he's not doing it. He's actually taking it from here. Okay, this is the art scroll version, but this is part of the oral Torah itself. Okay, this is the beginning of the Talmud, and the tractate of Brachot, and Brachos, Hey Amud Aleph. So it says, another teaching from Rav Levi Bar Chama, Amar Rav Levi Bar Chama, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. So one great Amora, a latter Talmudic expert, said in the name of an earlier one, Rav Shimon ben Lakish was an earlier a man of the Mishnah, he said, "My dichsiv, what does it mean by the following that is written? That sounds familiar?" Okay, that's the case. And he's going to explain it in the exact same way. In fact, he's going to go on a little further because he's going to say what the rest of the pasuk also means. But the Rambam is not making it up. He's getting it directly from the oral law itself. He said this is the oral law. This is the first redaction because this is one of the early, the Shimon ben Lakish, the person that's quoted under his name. Let me just tell you the structure. This is really jumping ahead, but nonetheless, we'll do it for this point. It says, "And Rabbi Levi Bar Chama said in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish." What that means is, the first person that's quoted here, Rabbi Levi Bar Chama, he was, I don't know the exact dates, but he maybe was like 300 or 400 after the Common Era, lived in Babylonia. Okay, he said, "In the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish." Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish was back about 200 years, 150 years before that. He was in Israel. Okay. Shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem, within about a generation after, the people still lived in Israel after the destruction of Jerusalem for a good 150 years. Okay, so this is the original. These are some of at least the second person, Rav Shimon ben Lakish, the person who this idea is quoted under, is one of the original redactors of the Mishnah itself, the oral law. Why it was redacted, why it was written down, we're going to talk all about. Okay? So the Rambam is actually quoting the oral law itself in explaining this. Very important. So we now have, I think, a structural understanding. And this is very important. This is probably the number one difference between what we call now Orthodox Jewry and any splinter sect or any movement that has ever happened. And that is, what is our understanding of what oral law is? And our understanding is right here. It's right in the Mishnah, it's right in the Rambam, and that is that this is our understanding from this pasuk in Exodus 24:12, that it, when the Torah was given, Moses wasn't there for 40 days and nights. It says later in Deuteronomy, "I didn't sleep, I didn't drink, I didn't eat." Okay? It didn't take 40 days for him just to go through Chumash. You know, you can do that in a day, easily. Okay, so that's to get all the five books, plus what it all means. Right? How it worked specifically, we don't know. But it took 40 days and 40 nights to get all that information down.
Excuse me, at this point I'll shut the door.
Yeah, I'm getting chilly too. If I'm cold, everyone else must be cold. I run hot.
I think it's not going to heat up.
I think it's the air conditioning is set to 68 or something.
If I shut the door, it would stop. But it would go off.
Oh.
Oh.
I just had it open because I was afraid that people wouldn't see us there. But it's been messing with the sun.
So, anyway. I'm just having a little problem. So, why do they call it mitzvah? That's the first time it's called oral Torah. It's called mitzvah. When I thought mitzvah was 613
right.
Mitzvah,
right.
And so that now I'm thinking, gee, it's just a study of the oral law. Is really a study of all 613 mitzvah,
no.
And that's probably not correct.
Not exactly. You're very close, but not exactly. The whole reason why the Talmud even has this discussion is that that's a very funny word for any word. It makes no sense no matter how you slice it and dice it. If I give you the entire Torah, what does it mean to give you a mitzvah? The mitzvah is in the Torah.
Right.
Right? So that's why they're having this discussion. It's almost like they're saying behind the scenes, this line makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense. If I just gave you this without anything else, and say, here, this is what this is. Here's your instructions for living. Figure it out. It makes no sense to say that I'm giving you the Torah. I'm going to give you the Torah. And I'm going to give you the mitzvah. But first of all, it's only singular. That doesn't make any sense. There's not one mitzvah. A mitzvah is a commandment. There's certainly more than one commandment. So what is that commandment? There can't be a commandment. It must be something different in this particular case. What you're suggesting is that the word mitzvah refers to the oral law. That's not true. It's only in this particular context where it clearly makes no sense as just mitzvah. The word mitzvah or tzaveh, which is I forgot how to say it in English, the verb that says thou must, you must, you know, it's a command. That appears many, dozens and dozens and dozens of times.
Okay, so I shouldn't confuse the word mitzvah as mitzvahs.
Right. It's not a singular plural issue. It's just in this context, it doesn't seem to make sense as its plain meaning. The plain meaning of mitzvah is a commandment. Okay. That's not how the Rambam understands it, and he gets it from here. That's not how the Mishnah understands it at all.
Okay?
Yeah. Do you understand that its structure is very awkward?
I do. I don't see it as such a contradiction because, you know, our mitzvahs are obviously, you know, expounded by the oral law. I don't know. I don't see it as such a contradiction, but okay, it doesn't matter. I understand Rambam saying the Purusha, but I don't see it as such a terrible contradiction. Mitzvah, why can't mitzvah just still mean mitzvah? Mitzvahs, after all, we have, you know, mitzvahs that are expounded in the oral law, mitzvahs expounded in the written law.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
I don't understand the problem.
Okay, it's not a problem if you look at it that way. It could be a problem because usually a mitzvah, for example, let's say keep the Sabbath, just as a mitzvah, that's a mitzvah to keep the Sabbath, or let's say remember the Sabbath, that's a mitzvah, okay? If that's what it means, well, first of all, it says explicitly, remember the Sabbath, somewhere in Deuteronomy, in the Torah. So if I'm going to give you the Torah, why do you need to give me the mitzvah? You've given me the Torah. The Torah has that mitzvah in it. So don't give me that. So it must mean if I told you remember the Sabbath, okay, I remember it. What does that mean, remember it? What does it mean to remember
the
Sabbath?
It's not enough detail on it.
Yeah. Does it mean to say it? Does it mean to, and how often do I have to say it? And what do I do to say it? Is there a ceremony to say it? You know, do I have to think it X number of times a day? And, you know, do I pause from my normal activities to think about it? You know, what does it mean to remember something, right? It's not a sufficiently clear commandment. It worked. So that's what we're talking about. So you're right. If you look at it that way, there's not a contradiction. So what the Rambam is not being mechadish here. He's not giving you a novel explanation. He's giving you just pshat. What does this mean? And it means this is the source of the understanding that there is an oral law.
Okay.
The oral law came at the same time as the written law. It was given to Moses from God at Sinai. Okay.
Why did he feel he had to give it in oral? Why didn't he just
beautiful.
Write the whole thing down?
We're going to get to that. Beautiful. We're going to definitely talk about that today. Okay. Wouldn't it be neat to know what that sounded like? You know, what the exact words that God gave to Moses, what did he say? Mm-hmm. Okay, we don't know. We have no record, and people don't know exactly what the discussion was. We're going to explore that now. Okay? First, let me tell you what it didn't sound like. Okay? This is, again, let's look at this again. Any part of this. This is the oral law. Okay? Said Rabbi Levi ben Chama, the son of Chama, said in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, what does it mean that it says this sentence, and I will give you the tablets of stone, the Torah, and the commandments that I have written to teach them? Luchos, the word tablets, that means that this refers to Ten Commandments. Okay, that can't be what God said to Moses. Why? Because, first of all, Reb Levi ben Chana was not alive yet. Reb Shimon ben Lakish was not alive yet. And that it can't work this way. Elsewhere, you'll see frequently rabbis disagreeing with each other. Okay? That can't be what Moses heard from God. Yeah, it could mean this or it could mean this. that would be silly, right? That would be absurd. Huh?
No, I'm just saying.
Well, yeah, we'll get to the why there's and what it means and how we explicate halacha when there are discussions. But all we're trying to identify now is that's not the words that God said to Moses. Okay, let's look at now the next source. I don't even have it yet. It's only one page front and back. And this is also, this is a very important source. This is the, what's called the Igeris. Igeris is Aramaic for letters, communications, of someone named Rav Shriri Gaon. The Gaonim are the leaders of the Jewish people from shortly after the Talmud was, when the Talmud was closed in about the year 500, 550, for about 500 years. Okay, and they were the heads of the yeshiva in Babylonia, where that was where the heads of the Jewish people, the Jewish people were scattered all over the known civilized world already then, more or less. Okay, but the majority of them were in Babylonia at that time. Certainly the heads of the yeshivas were there. So he was the head of one of the yeshivas, maybe the year 800 approximately. Okay, plus or minus 50 to 100 years. Okay, so look at the section that's kind of asterisk, and we're not going to even try to read the, that's Aramaic, that's not Hebrew, so you'll pardon me for just doing the English, from as long. Okay, as long as the Beis HaMikdash, that's the temple, was standing, each one of the sages taught his students the explanation of scripture, Mishnah, and Talmud, and before we, well, using words which he composed for the occasion. We'll stop there. There's much more there, but we'll stop right there. Just for the sake of brevity, the words Mishnah and Talmud don't refer to what we call Mishnah and Talmud. Hmm. It can't, because this refers to pre, right? So as long as the Beis HaMikdash was standing, there was no Mishnah and Talmud, okay? So it can't mean that. It doesn't mean that. It means the what we think of as discussions, repetitions, ongoing case study, that kind of stuff, okay? But it doesn't mean literally Mishnah. That's a translation. It's not the original. Okay, but that's not what I wanted to focus on. But I wanted to focus on the words that are kind of squiggly lined, using words which he composed for the occasion. Now, you're aware how careful we are with the written Torah, right? Any letter that seems to be an error, if it's caught on Shabbos reading, for example, the person who reads it has to stop. They look at it. They get people who know what they're talking about. If it looks like it's an error, you have to literally put the Sefer Torah. You can't use it at all. After Shabbos, you give it to a certified scribe who either can correct it, or if it can't be corrected because there's some technicalities, it has to be buried. We're that careful. It's a $30,000 investment that we can't even correct in some cases. Okay, I'm sure it's tempting, you know, when you're in the hole, but that's how careful we are. Not even a single letter, much less a word. Look at the oral law. Not at all like that. The oral law was not at all like that. The oral law, the teacher would use words which he composed for the occasion. What does that tell us?
Okay. Meaning the audience? Or
so you know what it means. I'm going to say something perhaps revolutionary to you, but you'll hear what it means in a moment. You want to know what God's words were, what it sounded like God gave to Moses? The answer is we don't care. It's entirely irrelevant to us. At best, we'd be confused. At worst, we'd misinterpret it. Okay. Because what is Torah? We're going to get right now to your question. And that is, why was it given oral in the first place? God, who knows everything and knows all generations, you know, knows the end to the beginning, that's our understanding. Whether you hold that way or not, that is certainly Jewish understanding. So he could have chosen to give the Torah, assuming that's what he wanted to do, it makes sense. You have a people, you want them to follow a certain way of life. He could have done any way he wanted to do it. He chose that some of it should be written, much of it should be oral, and it should be passed on generation to generation to generation. Why? Why? Why would you think?
Is that a rhetorical question?
No. Oh. It's an open question.
Why would he want? Let's repeat the question.
Okay. God could have given the Torah any way he wanted to do it. Whichever way he thought.
Why did you do it to Moshe and ask him to write it down?
Oh no, that's another question. Yeah. That's another question. He gave all of Torah to Moshe. And he says, write this part down. Mm-hmm. Whether he did it in Mount Sinai, whether they do it over the next 40 years, is a discussion, not for our purposes, okay? Bottom line, there was something that he said, write this down.
It was something transmitted that during that period of time.
Much was transmitted during that period of time. Some of it was going to be done orally. I mean, some of it was going to be written down by Moses. Okay, and it was very important to get every letter right. And you know, there's dots over letters some places, right? All that stuff. And the rest was going to be oral. That was God's view. That was his rutzon. That was desire. God says wins. You know, Moses didn't argue. Moses didn't say, God, I really think it'd be better if it was all written down. Or maybe he did say that, we'll never know. I wasn't there, there was no taping. But God wins the argument hands down every time. This is the way he chose to be, I assume, the most efficacious, most effective way for all the generations to know, to understand Torah. Why? That's the question. Why couldn't he have just said, I'm going to write everything down for you so you don't forget it? Or I want you to write it down so no one will forever forget it.
He obviously wanted the Jews to somehow, I don't want to say put their spin on it, but use their intellect to, to think it out, I think they're more participatory if it's written, it's certainly not ambiguous. If it's oral...
Do you want it to be ambiguous?
No, I don't think, especially with Jews. Why would you want that?
Right.
So I don't know. I'm arguing myself out of my answer.
Aviva, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I've heard all the explanation that, it's very, very easy to misinterpret the oral law unless you have a teacher.
Okay.
And it's very easy to have somebody read it by themselves and try to teach it themselves. So I think now, knowing what I know now, I have another interpretation of it. Tell me if this is correct. I just think, if you open a Gemara, try to learn it by yourself, forget about all the misinterpretations, and there's a lot of room for misinterpretations you can make. Without a teacher, you're not alone in Judaism. You are not alone. You must know that Torah flows down to a student. And I think without a teacher to sort of be that kli, you will not see sort of the music of Torah. You won't see what Torah looks like. I can just imagine... There's learning Torah from a book, and then there's meeting Abaye, himself, who apparently, I guess, this man could actually rejoice fully and still wear tefillin all the time. You have to know what it really looks like. And without a person to guide you and say, no, that's not how we live Torah, and that's not how we interpret it. It's different without that kli. You're not alone.
Very good. So you're basically saying that to really fully understand Torah, all of Torah, then one needs to hook into a visible, live representation of it.
Not only that, we have to submit yourself to them.
Right, good. Call him your leader. Call him your teacher. You are my teacher. I want to learn from you. Good, okay. So one way to answer the question, which, got to be careful not to leave the room right now because I'm going to explain, is, why didn't God choose to give it all in writing? And the answer is because he couldn't. So what is, obviously the question is, what is it that God can't do? That's blasphemous, right? Well, I can do anything, right? So we have to understand, Torah is not just do's and don'ts, right? We just think, some people think that Torah is do's and don'ts. We know that Torah is not a history book, but it's also not just thou shalt not, thou shalt not. In this case, don't, yes, no. Really, it's made up of a lot of sensitivities, of subtleties, of ideas and concepts. And I want to take us back to the yeshiva, okay? In a yeshiva, what often happens is you have two people, one sitting here, one sitting there, and they're discussing a certain point. At some point, one thinks he got it. Ah, and it becomes clear. I understand. I think I understand. Tries to sell it to the other guy. So A tries to say, I got it. And B says, yeah, let's hear it. So A says, blah, 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 like this, and this is what I think this, and this is why I think it makes sense. B is not sold. Okay, has tremendous respect for A, but he's a Jew, and so therefore he's not easily swayed. I don't understand. He says to him, it's that your discussion seems to be, somewhat reasonable. However, I have three objections for you. One, two, three. So then A says, I anticipated those. I had the same problem. I had the same thoughts, and this is how I address those. They go back and forth and back and forth until they got it, right? Does this system work better when two people know each other or when they don't know each other? The system that I just described, back and forth, back and forth.
Oh, I think when they know one another.
Yeah, the more they know each other, in fact, the better. Why? Why does it work better when they know each other?
I think they know their limitations, they know their intelligence level, they have respect.
What else? Good. All true. What else? What helps when two people know each other pretty well? What helps in the deciphering of a complicated issue?
They work together. Their heads are together on it.
Well, you got people who don't know each other work together. It's a little trickier. But there's a commonality. I know your language. You know my language. I know what you think. I know what you've been through. You know, and therefore I can give you things to relate to that I know you can relate to, because I know you, right? Right now I don't know you very well, so I can, you know, if I know you have children, I know what you've been through with your children.
Right.
If I know that you're married or you've been divorced, God forbid, or if, you know, whatever else, I know your history, then I can use those as examples to help you understand the point that I'm trying to make.
Right.
Because we frequently, in discussions and in trying to explain something to someone, we use stories, we use analogies, we use parallel cases. Right? Right? Think about it. In any science, in any philosophy, in any work, in any knowledge base, we do this. The more complex, the more we do this, because, you know, you try to search for the right word. It's like, what's the word? What's the word? And you say, it's like this. It's like running. It's like jumping. You know, and it's almost like it's not a game, because it's life. But you're trying to use words that the person will best understand, not only words, concepts, issues, parallels, you know, all that. That's how it works. How do you give over feelings, emotions? Right? You do that. If you write it down, it's lost. And it's lost right away because the next person who reads it doesn't have the same relationship to it.
Oh.
Okay? So the way to give over a feeling is very personal. It's one-on-one, depending on how I know you, you know me, and I know how you will relate to it. It's almost, you know, you give over in a story, in a parable, or some sort of artistic composition. So God told Moshe all the Torah in a way that he knew, as the best teacher possible, Moshe would understand it. You know, Moshe was a great man, but he was limited in time and space to Moshe. Okay? So, you know, how did Moshe grow up? He grew up in a palace, and then he eventually was threatened. He had to run away. He saw his people suffer, but then for 60 years he wasn't with his people, and then he lived with his father-in-law, and his father-in-law used to worship idols, and eventually came around, and then he came back, and he was very charismatic, but not particularly articulate, and then they left, and then, you know, he was great in stature, and all that affected who he was. And God knew that better than anybody, right? So when he gave him examples and parables and ideas, he didn't say that there was a rocket that went to the moon. You know, that's, what are you talking about?
Right.
You know, he said, he gave examples that Moshe Rabbeinu would be able to relate to.
Wow.
Okay? Right? And that's how Moshe gave it to Joshua, and so on and so forth. Right? So that's why when we say, number one, God could have written it all down, because it would be lost. It would be far less efficacious. It wouldn't work. It would be lost right away. Number one. Number two, when we said, why did he do it this way? The answer is it's the most effective way. But all this depends upon the strength of the relationship between teacher and student. The stronger the relationship, the more effective this is going to be, as we discussed.
I guess, would that be, God forbid, but I hate to say it, but almost a limitation of Talmud as it is in its form now?
Yes.
Yeah. Although it speaks no language, I mean, we talk about certain words that we just don't have. Shibuta fish. I don't know what that is.
Right. It's not just that. It's almost, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit today. Okay? But you're absolutely right. There is a strong limitation, which is, by the way, why there's a halacha not to write down the Mishnah and the Talmud. I'm not sure it says it here. We'll talk about it in just a bit. Okay? We'll talk about it just a little bit. Okay. There's two basic types of, there's two aspects of the oral law. One is halacha, and one is, it's usually called agadata, from the word agada, or tagid, or magid, speaking stories. Okay? Halacha is law. The other aspect is, the agadata, the stories, really is moral, ethical aspects of law. Various lessons, which are taught very differently. And I'm going to go over those about right now, the differences between the two. When we learn law, have you ever sat in a law, are you a lawyer by any chance? I don't know who you are.
I work in legal field.
Okay.
Yeah.
So have you ever sat in a law class in law school?
Yes.
Yeah, I have too. You?
A chance? No.
It's worth doing just once. Just, and no more. but I had law also in pharmacy school. So we have to, it's required. Very dry. But law is taught almost exclusively via case law. It's case, you know. Famous cases, instructive cases, it brings out a certain idea, a certain principle. That's how Mishnah, that's how oral law was taught, the legal aspects, the halachic aspects of it. Case law. So, if you go, for example, to the Mishnah, which refers to damages, the first one there is oxen goring. This guy has an ox, and he gores someone else, something else of somebody else's, okay? That's a case. What happens if it's a regular ox, which normally does not gore, just surprisingly went and gored something? What happens if it has a track record of goring? That's different. Maybe you should be more careful with this ox. And there are differences between those. Those are case laws. That's case law. And that's how we, that's how, that's how law schools are taught. Okay? Not quite with those examples, maybe. But that's the examples we have in the Mishnah as for that. All right. So those are examples of the principle that's required to learn about personal responsibility. Okay. We'll talk about Aviva's point now. That seems to be outdated, right? It is indeed outdated. If the Mishnah was continued the way it was meant to be continued, the oral law didn't stop with the Mishnah, and it, let's say it was written down today, or let's say it was never written down, and now you go to your Rebbe, and the Rebbe says, today we're going to learn about damages. He would not give oxen goring, right? He would give computer viruses or something. What's your responsibility if you send a virus and you didn't know that you had a virus, or maybe you've had maybe had three or four warnings already, you know, clean your computer, and then you send the virus to somebody else. What's your responsibility for that? Or dogs barking in the middle of the night, for that matter, you know, and far more common to our needs. Why wasn't it like that? We'll discuss that. But the reason, but it was set up to be oral from teacher to student, from teacher to student, from teacher to student, for all time. That's the way it was intended. Now you can see why it would make perfect sense. I would much easier understand, like you would, you know, the oral law if it was taught the way it was meant to be taught. It couldn't be, because we'll see why in a moment. But just differentiate. The second one is the moral ethical laws. Okay? And they're not laws, really. They're principles, but they're, how do you teach that? How do you teach what, you know, what the right thing to do is in interesting situations? What takes precedence, this good thing or this good thing? They're both good things. I have a choice. I have to do one or the other. I can't do both simultaneously. Okay? So the best way to teach that is stories. And those of us who are blessed to have children know that, because either we read them stories of great people, or we make up stories. That usually works with small kids. It's even the best kind, right? So, and often the stories have a dilemma, and the star of the story somehow gets out of the dilemma, and everyone lives happily ever after in stories, right? That's how these things are given. What we're trying to teach is some sort of principle behind the story. We make up the story. We know it's not true because we made it up. If we're giving over a story that we heard from somebody, maybe it's true, maybe it's elaborated, maybe it's not true at all. When we ask the question, is a midrash, a certain midrash, you know what a midrash is? Midrash is from drush. Drusha, Rabbi Cohen's giving his drusha, right? The drush is to expound, to take a concept, an idea, and, you know, just open it up. You know, to plumb the depths of it. So a midrash is taking a concept or a principle and making a whole story out of it, right? So the question of whether it's true or not, we're missing the whole point of the midrash. It doesn't matter if it's true or not, because that's not the point. Chaim Luzzatto, the Ramchal, he lived in about 16th century Italy. And he says, if you ask, did the midrash actually happen, your question is not valid. You're missing the whole point of a midrash. Okay, so it's not just Manny the Heretic saying this. It's actually the Ramchal, who's very well respected everywhere and by all peoples. Although during his life, He was harried. He went from place to place. He didn't have an easy life
at
all.
He had a horrible life.
Yeah, you know.
He died young.
He died young, too, on top of all that. Right. So,
duties of our heart, path of the just.
Right. But those are classics now. They were rejected during his life. And there better be an Olam Haba, because he's got to be happy now to see that he was right. And, you know, his works were very well-founded, and they're very successful more than that. But during his life, it was difficult, very difficult. Anyway, he says this, and it's true. The Midrash, and unfortunately, sometimes our kids learn Midrash, and I love when they learn Midrash. It's a good way to teach them, you know, how Avraham Avinu acted, how Yaakov acted, all the great people acted, you know. But they need to understand at some point, and usually I think pretty early on, what is Torah and what is Midrash. The reason is Torah we take quite literally. You know, if wild things happen like Noah this week, right? Wild stuff, right? But that's because it's miracles, and God can do miracles. So it happened, and the explanation is it's a miracle. God created the universe, he can do anything else he wants. But a midrash, whether it happened, didn't happen, it's like it's not relevant whether it happened. What do we learn from it? Because the whole point of a midrash is to learn something. Learn something about behavior, learn something about priorities, learn something about how to live as a Jew in the form of a story, because that's how emotions are best passed. Okay?
It's beautiful.
So, now we get to, and we'll close with this, is what happened to the chain. Why? Since we've discussed and we decided, we're all, I think, unanimous that, gosh, it would have been great if the oral law continued to this very day. We would have understood it a whole lot better. Wouldn't have to know Aramaic, for one. But beyond that, these species of fish or these animals, or, you know, it's not just this, not just translations of words, but the whole concepts are very, it takes a lot to even, you know, bring it. Why did it happen? So let's go back to the Rambam. That's this. Flip to page. Okay. Let's go to page 14 first. Okay, that's, it should say 2 in circle, big circle, and a small 14 on top. Okay. What I did was I just photocopied the English. Okay. So it says Moses gave it to Joshua. And if you skip down a little bit now, it'll say, on the third paragraph, under the line, similarly throughout his life, Joshua taught the oral law. I'm not sure what Mar something is. The elders received the tradition from him. The elders are the judges. Eli received the tradition from the elders and from Pinchas, who was the Kohen Gadol. Samuel, that's Shmuel Hanavi, received from Eli. So you see one-to-one-to-one-to-one transmission. Now, everybody learned all the Torah. School children learned it. Parents taught their children. Okay, but there was one person in every generation who was the final word. He was the responsible party. He or she. Devorah, the prophetess, was during her life. She ruled Israel for 40 years. She was the final word in Torah. And so now you have to flip down a couple of pages to list name after name after name until you get to page 18, which is 3 in the circle there, where the arrow is. We'll go into this in detail in the history section. Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Shimon, and referred to Rabbeinu HaKadosh, received the tradition from his father, who is Rabbi Shimon, as well as from Rabbi Lazar ben Shemua, and from Rabbi Shimon and his colleagues, that's another Rabbi Shimon. Okay, Rabbeinu HaKadosh composed the Mishnah. He was the one that actually wrote it down. From the days of Moses, our teacher, Moshe Rabbeinu, until Rabbeinu HaKadosh, we're talking about a period of about 1,600 years. It's a long time. No one had composed, I'm not sure what this is, a something or other, for the purpose of teaching the oral law in public. It was never written down in full. Instead, in every generation, the head of the court or the prophet of that generation would take notes of the teachings which he received from his masters for himself and teach them verbally in public. But as Reb Shmuel Gaon says, in his own words, right? It was never given as, I'm going to read to you the Gettysburg Address now, okay? It was like, I have notes here, and I would say, as my teacher so-and-so would say, you know, look at my notes, okay? That's the extent of note-taking. That was all the notes was used for. But they would always use their own words. And one second, if it says, I think it's all we need to look at here. So the question is why? Why did he, it's not addressed here, But here you see when the Rambam gives the whole history of this, there's clearly a stop here. And the reason for that is Jews, they're talking about the year between 150 to 200 in the Common Era. Okay? Jerusalem was destroyed in the year 70. Okay? And Beitar was where the rest of the Jews lived pretty much. It was a huge stronghold of several tens of thousands of Jews. Walled city, perhaps a little bit south of Jerusalem. There's a city called Beitar now. We don't know if that's the Beitar of old. Some people say it is. Some people are not so sure. I don't know what the scholars think right now. Okay? But if it is, it's very close to Jerusalem, maybe 10 miles south, 5, you know, 12 miles south, perhaps. You been there?
No? No, I mean, I've heard of it.
Yeah.
I've not been there.
Very close. So, lovely community. At any rate, Beitar held tens of thousands back then. And it was in the year 135, Bar Kokhba, if you've heard of him, he was the leader, the secular leader, if you will. Not that he was secular, but he was like the main general and so on. And Rabbi Akiva was the Torah leader at the time. The city was wiped out in the year 135. Okay, and that was the last hope, really, that the Jews would somehow weather the storm of the Romans. As I said, they continued to live in Israel, but it was like a small patch here, a small patch. It was learning in small yeshivas, but it wasn't a large, thriving community longer, unfortunately. Okay. At that point, read in Tisha B'Av, for example, some of the stories of what went on in Jerusalem between the year 65 and year 70, especially towards the very, very end. Survival was a question. Okay, whether anybody would survive was a question. They were being starved. They were, you know, barely had enough food. They couldn't eat for their children. It was horrible, horrible. And during that kind of situation, it's not that you couldn't learn, it's just that people, and this is documented, people were not able to focus enough to have that relationship with their teachers. The Gemara talks about it, where two people would leave the Beis Medrash, and one would say, the teacher said this, and the other said, no, he didn't, he said this. This is just right after leaving. Now, we're thinking about college, and of course that happens all the time. But this is not college. I mean, they took this stuff very, very seriously. And this had not happened before. So Rabbi Yehuda was the inarguable leader of the Jewish people. He had it all. He had wisdom. He had charisma. He was very close to the Romans. People knew him. They respected him, which is important if you want to have any kind of ongoing life. And you know, he went to bat for the Jewish people a number of times using the relationship that he had. He was wealthy. He was independently wealthy, which is also important because that means he could travel without worrying about where am I going to get my bread next week. Right? And he did travel. He went to every single place that there was an important Beis Medrash in Persia and back in Israel. And he convinced everyone, it's time to write this down because if we don't, it'll be lost forever. But people don't remember what anyone says anymore. Okay. Later, but towards the end of the series, we'll actually look at the first disagreement. We actually know what the first disagreement was, you know, in oral law. Everything was absolutely pure without any disagreement whatsoever from the year, you know, from Mount Sinai, from about, you know, 1400 BCE perhaps, until about the year 100 to 200 before the Common Era. And then there's the first episode where there's a difference of opinion. Okay? And there are tzaddikim for many, many years who actually fasted on the anniversary of that date, believe it or not, because they know that was the beginning of the end. Well, we don't have a pure, unadulterated, we know what the rule is in the case, in the situation. Okay. We'll talk about that later on.
What was the instance that they disagreed on?
Yeah, whether, it's a subtle point. It's a subtle point in whether of a korban, how to do a specific part of korban. Whether you put the hands on, dump the harbins, pardon me?
Yes, it was,
you know about
that?
No. It's Yom Tov. No. It's Yom Tov, but it's all Yom Tov. It's all any Yom Tov. Whether you're supposed to lean, not lean, so on. So it's a subtle technical point.
So it was Rabbi Yehuda who felt that it should have been written down because he was so concerned that it would be lost forever.
The alternative was far worse. He knew that writing it down would have a very negative effect. Why? Because he says, from now on, the parables that you teach will be my parables. That's what he was saying, basically. The examples...
So that's what he's saying?
Yeah.
That's what he's saying.
Those words, you know, Sefer says, in the words of his choice, no more. from the time of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, if you want to teach oral law, you teach Mishnah. These are the words we're going to all agree on. Okay?
Once again, this is halfway through the second century at the first.
Somewhere between 135 is when Beitar was destroyed. Something 150 and 200 was when the Mishnah was finalized.
When was that first disagreement that happened?
I don't know. I'm looking for it. And it's about 100 years, 200 years before that. So it's even before the Common Era.
Okay, so it's 100 to 200 years before the Mishnah was even compiled.
Yes, yeah. So by then there was lots of disagreements already.
I'm curious again. Once again, it was whether to do smicha on Yom Tov or...
On Yom Tov, whether you should do smicha, which means leaning on the animal, because you're not supposed to make use of an animal, right? You're not supposed to have, not hana, but make use of an animal. But smicha is, the question is smicha an absolutely obligation, where it's called me'akev? It's like, you know, if you don't do smicha, is the carbon gone? Or is it an additional mitzvah that, okay, we'll abandon that mitzvah, but the carbon's still fine? That was the disagreement. I told you, technical. Okay? And that's in Chagiga. Okay? So that is why it had to be written down.
Okay. That helps a lot, because when you first read this, I thought, gee, this is just his spin, his ego. You know, obviously I knew that wasn't the answer, why he wanted to put it in his words, but he had a more, you know...
Oh, he was the most...
Higher...
Yeah, if it was just a revolutionary type of rabbi, no one would have taken him seriously, but everyone believed. I mean, everyone knew that he was doing it for the better good.
He actually saved the whole...
He saved Judaism as we know it. So and we call him Beino Kaddish to this day, despite the fact that we have to learn about Oxen Goring, which, you know, so it's like the alternative would be far worse. As bad as that is, it's better than the alternative. The alternative is we wouldn't have no idea whose opinion to follow, and it's just, you know, it's the chaos, right? So that led to the Mishnah, right? That was the Mishnah. Mishnah is virtually all cases. This case is how we hold this. Occasionally there's disagreements. He holds like this, he holds like that. Next case, right? That's the Mishnah. Over the next 200-300 years, there were many, many, many discussions. This is what the Mishnah meant. No, it didn't mean that. It couldn't mean that, because look over here. The same person who you're quoting is saying here says something that has a different principle over there. So all those dialogues and discussions went into the formation of the Gemara, much bigger, much longer, because it's dialogue now. It's like, he says this, he says that. Argument back and forth. So sometimes a discussion and argument will go 3-4 pages long. To try to resolve it, and sometimes it doesn't resolve it. Sometimes at the end of it, it just throws his hands up and says, "We don't know," you know. But it's important to understand how that whole dialogue went. That's the Gemara, or that Gemara is Aramaic. Talmud is Hebrew. They're equivalent words. They mean the same thing. And that was finalized about the year 500, approximately. But it never ended there, because people continued to interpret, reinterpret, and continue to interpret these rules. I'll give you one story kind of to end, but I had the great good fortune of taking my son and my oldest daughter to Israel last summer, the summer of 2005, and I have a cousin who lives in Har Nof in Jerusalem. Har Nof is with the western edge of Jerusalem, and right across the street from where my cousin lives is a yeshiva, so we went there for Shabbos. We went to daven there for Shabbos, and the yeshiva is really primarily for Balei Tshuva. It's run by Rabbi Horowitz, who has a tremendous yichus. We say his lineage. He is the great grandson of great, great, great people, and while he was there, we struck up a conversation. It was very, very sweet. And he gave me a book of his, a book that he wrote. And I gave it, when I came back home, I gave it to Rabbi Bess. And he was so so happy. I never seen Rabbi Bess so happy. So, you know, I was like, he's happy a lot, actually. But he was so delighted. And this was back in 2005, right? So after Sukkot this year, he thanked me again for it, because he used it in explaining certain things in the Gemara and Sukkah, which he never understood very clearly. So to this day, people who are contemporaries of ours are still defining, redefining, and still redefining what this means. So Rabbi Bess would spend, he probably went through that tractate a dozen times. Now with this extra book, understood a couple of things that he never really clearly got. It takes someone to explain it again and again. So the process has not stopped, and it continues to go on. to this very day. Now, I've still not made the bridge between, connected the bridge between the Gemara and today, which I will do later on. But again, for the next 3 weeks, we're going to take a pause from all the history stuff and really focus really on us as the neshama. Who are we? The neshama, the soul, the person, the goof, who are we? How we make decisions? And what is the aspect of that, the natural science of the spiritual world? How are we affected by all that? Okay? So that's where we're going to go for the next 3 weeks, and then we'll continue after that with the history section.
Sure. Thank you. Good. Thanks very, very much for letting me drag you out here.
We're done today.
Great. Really, really.
Press the button.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Very cool.